So let's move on. This is our 10th anniversary lecture from Deborah Ayer. Deborah is the founder of High Performance Learning. She is the guru on all things high performance, having spent a great deal of time researching and working in this field. And it's actually an honour as well as a pleasure to introduce Deborah to us today. She is the foremost lead thinker in this area, and having now been freed from the operational work of high performance learning, she is even further in front of the foremost thinkers because she's had plenty of time to do the thinking. And she's done wonderfully to come together with a real challenge for us. And her lecture this morning, which will be followed up by a number of speakers throughout the day, is Beyond School Improvement. Deborah, welcome to the stage. Very much looking forward to you being here. Thank you.
Morning, everyone. It's quite unusual for me to actually deliver a lecture as opposed to a talk, but I really wanted to make some particular points as we come to the 10th anniversary of HPL. And so consequently, I thought it was just easier and more productive to do it in the lecture. So I know that sitting still is very hard for people whose lives are incredibly active. So bear with me and do your best. So now it's 10 years since I published the Red Book and launched High Performance Learning in Schools. And over that period, hundreds and thousands of children and young people in forward-looking schools have benefited from being educated in a way that teaches them how to think. And it prepares them not only for exams, but also for their future lives. And in this lecture, I want to talk about what we've learned from utilizing this concept in schools and lessons that can help us to move it forward in the future. I want to start by putting it all in context. I grew up in rural North Yorkshire, and if you were to ask what I was like as a child, I think you'd hear the word curious. I was interested in everything. I asked endless questions, and I could be really quite annoying. I wanted to know about why we did things in certain ways, why things were the way they were, why people took particular actions. And my parents were generally relatively tolerant about this. They didn't mind these interrogations, and they thought curiosity was, on the whole, a pretty good thing. But sometimes they kind of ran out of patience, and they'd give me a flippant or sometimes wrong answer to something just for fun. So that was a bit confusing for me. I always pick it up with them. In my adult life, I always tell them about the things they confuse me about. Living in the country, as we did, there were lots of opportunity to study wildlife and fauna and flora and animals and bugs. And I was really fascinated. I remember being fascinated by the newts that lived in a pond in the field behind our garden and watching them for hours. What I did not know was that desire to understand was at the heart of the memory process. So while I thought I was just enjoying myself, I was actually encoding, storing, and retrieving. In short, I was creating long-term memory. When I went to school, I found that curiosity was definitely not valued. In my particular independent girls' boarding school, knowledge and comprehension were the order of the day. And any challenges or requests for clarifications were firmly rebutted. It was learn it and repeat it. If you want to do well, learn it better and repeat it accurately. I found school frustrating. And my teachers saw me as quite disruptive. My tendency not to take things at face value and ask questions when I didn't understand was seen as a real irritant. And to be honest, I was sometimes pretty disruptive. I was even sometimes a bit subversive. I think I could say that my schooling and me just were not a very satisfactory pairing. I did okay, but I was unsure about my capabilities. And school didn't really see me as a student worth bothering with. You'll have come across that kind of student. So I came out of school with acceptable but unremarkable results, and I thought of myself as a middle-ranking student, and I always would be. Many students actually feel that way. School is a very powerful influencer when it comes to self-identity. And it had a strongly negative impact on me. Higher education, by contrast, was an absolute revelation. Curiosity, critical thinking, independent thought, they were basic requirements. Suddenly, the things I liked to do were valued, and I thrived. Nothing was seen as secure without compelling evidence, and the ability to critique and make judgments, and indeed come up with new ideas, was a favoured approach. Through investigation and deep learning, ideas and concepts could be encoded in long-term memory, ready for effective retrieval. I also learned that collaboration was really valuable. I'd always been sociable and had friends, but these intellectual collaborations were satisfying in a different way. And together, we could make more progress than we did as individuals. We pulled each other along. I was seen as a successful student, and that was how I learned to see myself, capable of more than I had previously thought. My journey is not in any way unique. You have students who thrive in one environment, less so in another. The pervading environment makes a big difference to self-identity, and it's something I'm very interested in. You will not be surprised then to learn that when I entered the education profession as a primary school teacher, I was inevitably going to stay curious. I was immediately fascinated by why some individual children found the learning process easy and could learn really straightforward things very, very easily, and some did not. And in particular, I taught a girl called Rona, and she found maths very hard. She was year six, and I'd work with her on a concept, and she would seem to grasp it. I'd go home happy. But then the following day, it was as if we'd never had the conversation. She just couldn't retain that new learning. Why was that? Reflecting on it over quite a long period of time, I came to the conclusion that if I better understood the processes that children who found learning easy display, then I might be able to better construct learning for those who didn't. And in effect, that started me on a lifelong journey of investigating into how the most successful learners think and learn. It took me from senior leadership in schools to local authority advisor, from there to academia, and subsequently to major system leadership roles. And at all points, I was looking at understanding the learning processes of successful learners and how we can use that to improve teaching for everyone. Learn from the people who do it well. Now, when it comes to understanding the learning processes of the most successful learners, and we could use a different term for the most successful learners, we could call them gifted. And some of you may have used that term. Some of you may do this in school. But the thing about it is, there's a lot of really useful research into these very successful learners. And the highly regarded Canadian academic, Bruce Shaw, whose work I like a lot, summarized it. He summarized what we know about how the most successful learners think and learn in three major bullet points. And I want to use these three major bullet points with you. The first is, they do not seem to use strategies that others never use. Secondly, they differ from others in the creativity and the extent to which they draw upon this repertoire of intellectual skills that are nonetheless available to absolutely everyone. And thirdly, what expert performance looks like is using metacognition, strategy flexibility, strategy planning, complexity, extensive webbing of knowledge. Sound familiar? Of using that knowledge of both facts and processes. So I want you to think about those three things for a moment. Firstly, these very successful learners, there is nothing unique about them. They are not a separate species of the population. What is different then? Well, you could say that successful learners have what we all have, but they use it better. That's all. They have what we all have, but they use it better. So the question in my mind was, well, how do they know when, where, and how they should use these processes? And what do we mean when we say they use them creatively? So I was interested in exploring that a bit more fully. How or where do individuals learn to learn successfully? To use their capabilities? Is it the result of natural aptitude, or being taught or coached by parents? Is it through great teaching? How does it happen? Well, it turns out it can be any or all of these. Circumstances really do play a big part in it. For example, Richard Feynman, who's a Nobel Prize winning American physicist, was not himself seen as a strong student in school. Interesting that, isn't it? Nobel Prize winning physicist. He didn't score high enough to get into the school's gifted and talented program. That says something about how those students were chosen. But his father, in his spare time, used to take him on nature walks. And he taught him to observe carefully, to investigate, to be precise, to think critically, and to link new knowledge to old. That is how Richard Feynman became a high performer. So he learned from his parents. But I could equally point you to examples of individuals, very high performers, Nobel Prize winners, field medal winners, other forms, Olympians, other forms of high performers, where teachers, often one influential teacher, plays exactly the same role in helping that person to understand the things that are important when it comes to learning. So, there is just no doubt about this statement that I'm about to make. And it is so fundamental that every person who works in school should be thinking about this. Creating successful learners can be taught. Everybody has the capability to become a successful learner. They just have to learn how to do things better. And we know what good looks like. We know exactly the kinds of things that help you become a better learner. So I'm thinking to myself, well, shouldn't we try and help everybody become like these successful learners? For goodness sake, isn't that what teaching's about then? Isn't that its whole point? Then I thought, well, that's all very well. But how? How do we do that? Well, we need to model it, nurture it, support it. And of course, if everyone is going to get better and become successful learners, they are going to need a lot of practice. But again, I'm asking myself, well, practice of what exactly? Well, Anders Ericsson's work from Florida State points out that you need to be much more precise about practice if you want it to be useful. He calls it deliberate practice of the things that matter. So in this case, we know what matters. People like Bruce Shaw and many others have actually articulated what matters. It's been extensively researched in psychology. We are absolutely clear about what matters if you want to develop cognition. So this canon of research already has identified the skills. So it is these elements that we need to practice. And those elements are the ACPs and the VAAs, if individuals are to achieve school and lifetime success. So Shaw says there are no special characteristics. Obviously, it's not just Shaw. He is not alone. I'm just using his work as illustrative because a lot of the key researchers in this field come up with very similar findings. There are no special circumstances. We can all do it. Really? I thought, as I'm looking at my set of students. I wanted to put that proposition to the test. Try it out. See how far we could get. And in doing so, it was obvious that this experiment had two research questions. Firstly, the question of how, in a practical sense, can we as teachers teach students over time to become proficient in these things that matter? How can we teach them to understand, value the successful learner competencies, and also help these students to reach a state where they're confident in when, where, and how to deploy them creatively? Of course, it is inevitably over time. There's no quick fix. Even Richard Feynman had to go on many walks with his father, one supposes, and no doubt he had other similar learning experiences before he was confident to apply these ideas independently. So there's a process of learning how to do them and then being confident enough to apply them independently. Even then, he will probably have made mistakes. Mistakes are part of learning. But over time, he became much more efficient and confident. And that's what successful learners demonstrate, their proficiency. And with their proficiency comes that confidence. And for some learners, it comes quite young and early. And for others, it takes a long time to get there. But it can still come. Secondly, if this was to become a teaching pedagogy, then teachers would need to buy into the idea that special circumstances for individual students do not exist. People are not born gifted. They absolutely are not. So this was inevitably going to be very challenging. Because accepted public wisdom is there are different levels of ability, and only some students have high ability, and hence it's only they who can develop into high performers. That's why all these backward-looking schools have gifted and talented programs, because that's what they think. It is utterly disproven by the research. But accepted public wisdom is that you've got these different levels of ability, only some people have high ability, only they can do well. So this mindset would be a barrier to realizing the development of the cognitive skills that really matter. But it was absolutely vital. It had been firmly and repeatedly proven over time that what a teacher expects is what a teacher gets. So if they only expect that some people can do well, only some people do well. We've known this as far back as 1968. I know Melanie likes this piece of research particularly. It's the famous Pygmalion in the classroom piece of research that absolutely demonstrated that if you tell teachers that particular students are going to the late bloomers and can become high performers, they will become high performers. Even though they weren't ever late bloomers, they were just a random sample of the overall cohort of students. What a teacher expects is what a teacher gets. So teachers, if all of this was going to work, teachers would need to recalibrate the art of what they thought was possible, change their mindset. So how are we going to do that? This then is how high performance learning came into being as a concept. It's a practical mechanism for solving these very fundamental and critical questions. It positions the idea that everyone can at the front and centre, and it recognises that only if teachers buy into this idea can it ever have any chance of being a reality. It goes on to identify the research-derived list of intellectual competencies, the ACPs and VAAs, associated with successful learning, and shows how they work in harmony to create these successful learners. It invites teachers to teach in a way that makes the ACPs and the VAAs the drumbeat of the classroom, working over time to increase the proportion of students who meet the criteria that defines what it means to be a successful learner. It challenges the school to help their students develop the agency that comes with understanding how they learn and how to learn better. All this inevitably leading to better academic outcomes, but also the intellectual confidence that makes them life and work ready. So, back in 2016, the High Performance Learning book, High Performance Learning, How to Become a World-Class School, was published, and the HPL concept was formally introduced to schools. So I was curious about how this would work in practice and at scale. I wanted to start what Roger Bregman, in his recent Reith lectures, calls a moral revolution. I wanted schooling to change. Of course, I knew it would be tough, but I had the vision and a scalable strategy, and all I needed was the unflagging persistence to make it happen. And goodness me, I have needed it. The HPL book, it gained an encouraging response from the start, and there was a lot of interest globally. I think this is because it was welcomed by educationists, because teachers typically say, it's really a bit of a summation of everything I've always thought teaching should be. Or at least enlightened teachers say that. Got profile from people of influence like the TES. And we began to see this happening in schools in different places. As far apart as here's Sharpsville in South Africa, very, very severely disadvantaged children. And I was over in Washington, D.C., talking to ministers of education for all the South American countries. all of whom are interested in the same thing. How do we improve education? Because we know there's a lot of problems with the current model. But it was gratifying to receive the affirmation of the overall concept, but that did not mean that school leaders were prepared to change their schools and work in a new way. They liked it, but they weren't going to change. Where's the evidence of impact, I was asked. I don't know, I replied. No one's tried it yet. I'm inviting you to create the evidence base. What I can say is, it can't do any harm, and it may prove to be absolutely transformational. It is for this reason that I would like to pay thanks to those pioneering head teachers and principals who in the first couple of years were brave enough to join this campaign for better education. I am really and truly in your debt. And we have, I know Jane Gandy here and Stefan Sommer who are in that category. And there are others. This could never have happened if those people had not been brave enough to see the possibility and open-minded enough to take a chance on it. So it was exciting to see what happened when schools began to implement. Some of the outcomes were just as anticipated and some were not. There were areas where we ran into problems on implementation and others where the impact was much more significant than even I'd hoped for. Right from the outset, it was clear that working in this way has a profound impact on students and their confidence. They just got what it was all about. From budding entrepreneurs in Abu Dhabi to adolescents in Cornwall, we were suddenly had students who held and expressed their own opinions, were confident in their learners and relaxed about their own learning journey. They knew they were capable and they were building towards high performance. And if they were not there yet, right now, it was just not yet. The pressure was off. They were happier, enjoyed school more, and because of that, they achieved better results. It was humbling and frankly, sometimes very moving. For example, Blake, at Albany Learning Trust in Chorley, Lancashire. Peter and Linda are both here from Albany. He was a school refusenik and keen boxer. And hearing him explain how HPL had been a light bulb moment for him that had helped him to improve both in school and in boxing, it remains a poignant reminder to me of why all of this is truly worthwhile. So, as expected, the mindset shift in teachers proved challenging. We needed to line up the evidence from psychology and neuroscience, but it was tough going. It helped that Carol Dweck's work on growth mindset was in vogue, as this was moving general opinion from a fixed mindset to an understanding that intelligence is developmental, which is broadly where most people are in the field of psychology. But in 2016, when I published the first book and we embarked on HPL, most schools were firmly locked into segmenting students by ability and using predictive testing to set targets for achievement. They were locked into the concept of destiny, with the possibility of a small amount of growth, stretch targets, in some of the more ambitious schools. You may think that that was not just in 2016. In some schools, this still exists now. An absolute nonsense to think that you can ever reliably predict eventual academic outcomes based on previous performance. It's not possible. So, many fierce debates occurred in schools adopting HPL around this everyone can agenda, and they still do. But remember the evidence, though. The most successful learners do not have special powers. They just use what we all have, but they use it better. Finally, we encountered the problem of programs. Schools had programs to counter every issue or problem. They were segmenting the process of schooling and seeing every aspect as separate and needing different treatments. Behavior programs, engagement programs, curriculum programs, well-being programs, inclusion programs, etc., etc. It was complex. By contrast, we were saying HPL is not a program. It's a holistic way to view the educational process with a clear and simple goal in mind of creating successful learners. It's an example of what is termed in the literature system thinking. So system thinking is holistic solutions to organizational problems rather than separate solutions to organizational problems. We settled on describing it as a lens through which to view all aspects of the school's teaching and learning, and the HPL adoption schemes as the mechanisms to help schools to move into that space, into that way of thinking. However, this program-focused approach was so prevalent in schools that it was really hard to get school leaders to think in a different way. This approach was expected by inspectors, by governors, and it took school leaders with exceptional vision, ambition, and bravery to take the bold decision to work differently. Thankfully, the school system has some exceptional school leaders, and they're in all sectors, in international schools, in independent schools, in maintained schools. And it is those people who saw the potential of HPL and helped to create an HPL community who could work out any wrinkles in implementation. These three early prominent issues remain live, and in some cases are even more evident now than they were at the start. But the subsequent 10 years, we've learnt a lot about the power of working in the HPL way. As I launch the 10th anniversary edition of High Performance Learning, How to Become a World-Class School, we have a much clearer understanding of how to move HPL theory into practice in schools. And we've got significant evidence of its impact on students, on teachers, and in schools. So, we now understand, in a practical sense, exactly how teachers can teach students over time to become proficient learners who can reach high levels of attainment. That was my first research question. How would we do it? We know now how to do it. There are many ways to do it, and we know which ways are possible and which work best. We found that HPL aligns really well with other developing ideas in, for example, cognitive psychology or assessment for learning, and we're going to be hearing about some of these things as we go through our conference today. And also, they're very, very helpful in implementing the HPL approach in classrooms. We've also established that the seven pillars are crucial vehicles in generating a robust and sustainable HPL landscape in HPL schools. They create the context in which teaching the ACPs and the VAAs in a way that develops the ACPs and VAAs can thrive. Each one is vital for creating the context of helping teachers to teach in a way that supports students to acquire mastery of the HPL competencies. But we've also learned that teaching in this way can be very satisfying for teachers, and it aligns really well with their values and their professionalism. So far, so good. On my second research question of how to get teachers to buy into the idea that special circumstances do not exist, this remains a work in progress. Even in schools that have been HPL schools from the early days, it's still a work in progress. Over the last 10 years, the research base has become increasingly confirmatory, with neuroscience developing rapidly as a field and demonstrating that neural pathways can indeed be developed and enhanced. Evidence for the proposition is now overwhelming, so we're on safe ground. But evidence does not always change beliefs. Moving teachers into this mindset and retaining them there is an ongoing maintenance job for school leaders. And those of you who are leading HPL in your schools know this full well. In a survey currently on the UCL website, 94% of primary teachers thought genetics were at least as important as the environment in determining intelligence. That is a very worrying statistic. 94% believe that your genetic profile will determine your performance in school. Equally, according to the Educator magazine, 79% of teachers believe that what the CATS test predict is accurate, whereas the research shows that at its very best, CATS tests can only predict about a third of a student's performance. So it's against this background that HPL is operating. Misunderstandings abound. And more than that, even when you've got your teachers into the space where they believe, their actual behaviour may not reflect that belief. Believing it is one thing, doing it is something else. The familiar is really comfortable. And the challenges that HPL makes to some of the accepted school practices like setting or differentiation is much less so. The HPL community has got better and better at making the case and supporting senior leaders on how to approach all of this in their school community. But the prevailing school improvement practice, where we segment students, makes it challenging for senior leaders to be the creative, and they have to be creative and persistent and unyielding on this particular topic. We also have learned a lot and a much better understand the optimal conditions for success. All schools that adopt HPL see impact. But for some schools, it is absolutely transformational. And I was really interested to understand what's the difference. Why does it work so brilliantly in some schools and adequately in others? And the new book has a whole section on this, in which I think makes an interesting read. I'm going to summarise to say that there are three key points that seem to be particularly pertinent. The first point is these schools where it's really transformational, they show fidelity to the concept. That means that they use HPL fully. So all schools see an impact on students, but the level of impact is directly related to the degree to which the school takes the concept really seriously and makes it the DNA of their school. So zero tolerance of staff not doing it. that absolutely it becomes the way we do things around here. Everybody knows that's what we do, how we do it. This finding's important for many reasons, but particularly because unless as a school you're embracing HPL fully, then the people who miss out are the hard to reach students. Hard to reach is an accurate term. So a school must use high performance learning really systematically if they're to optimize its impact and ensure that students from disadvantaged backgrounds and those with SEND, the harder to reach students, they will only really gain benefit if it's pervasive in the school. Absolutely the drumbeat of the way the school works. Secondly, precision. Where schools create a community of practice with teachers investigating in research and practice how each of the individual ACPs can be optimized in their teaching, then it's the power of each is enhanced. Unleashed teachers working within the HPL framework honestly create magic. Awesome practice is the result. I am absolutely staggered by what I see, and I know that all colleagues working in HPL feel the same. By contrast, schools who choose to make changes to the research-derived technology because I find it too demanding for the little ones, those words are too difficult, or they only pay lip service to the use of it in teaching, so they might remember to mention it occasionally, but not regularly and frequently, they see a reduced impact. It just becomes another initiative used well by some and not others. It becomes vaguely programmatic. They are not really embracing this in the way they need to embrace it. So fidelity, precision. And before I leave precision, I have to mention my colleague and good friend Stefan Sommer from MISC, who is a linguist, and he was very quick when we first started HPL to point out that being accurate with the language is the key to success. If you start to mess about with it, you've lost. These terms are research derived. You need to be accurate, just as you use the correct term in any language. It's not just an approximation, it has to be the right thing. So the third thing was longevity. The most successful schools are those who've used this over time. The impact of HPL is cumulative. The longer you do it, the better it gets. The longer a child is exposed to this, the greater their chance of moving to become a successful learner. So if you think about, you know, you've got a proportion of successful learners all right from the get-go. Over time, that proportion increases. And the longer you do it, the greater the proportion. It's the schools who've really made HPL the DNA of the school that are now reaping quite extraordinary and well-deserved rewards. Outstanding exam results, fantastic post-school destinations, and inspection reports. But more than that, MAT Excellence Awards, International Principal of the Year, letters from the Secretary of State conveying congratulation on pupil outcomes, parent power rankings, etc., etc. Those schools are just kicking the ball out the park. And well done, all of you. It's absolutely fantastic. I could never have dreamt you would get this far with the concept, or that the concept would deliver so well. I look forward to seeing where you go next with HPL, because you're breaking new ground in terms of what is possible. So, we have established proof of concept. The HPL approach works. Not only that, it works in different contexts. It's curriculum and context neutral. It can be used successful anywhere in the world with any curriculum. And again, we have some fantastically innovative schools. Our colleagues in Hanoi, Vietnam, who are with us over this next couple of days, using it in conjunction with the Vietnamese curriculum and the Cambridge curriculum. It can be used anywhere or with any educational tradition, and with schools at any stage of their developmental process. We've worked in 23 different countries. We've shown that it can work in many places. All it takes is a degree of interpretation to look at how to make these general ideas work in particular contexts. No school in any education system is actually starting from scratch, so it's auditing what is currently a strength and where are the deficits, which are kind of fundamental to making HPL work. And you all go through that process when you start the adoption process for HPL, which is to recognise that you are already doing some of this. What you're going to do is you're going to do more, and you're going to do it more deliberately and more systematically. But it's also been established that HPL impacts in positive and quite unexpected ways. And you have to say, that's really encouraging. So at the student level, the quest to create more successful high-performing learners has had really particular impact on traditionally underperforming groups. So in the case of children from low-income and disadvantaged backgrounds, HPL resets expectations. These are the students with low aspirations and low intellectual capital. They don't acquire the relevant cognitive and learner skills at home necessarily, and hence they stand to benefit disproportionately when this is all explicit in school. If everybody's expected to do well, everyone can become a high performer. That includes them. Family background is not seen in an HPL school as a reason for lower attainment, and that's different. It's radically different from the school improvement model. Equally, students with special educational needs and disabilities. So when I was first introducing HPL into schools, I was really concerned that it might not be suitable for students with special educational needs and disabilities. But on the contrary, it has proved immensely empowering. They and their parents say that when teachers start talking about what their child could do, might do, instead of focusing entirely on the deficit, it's an absolute step change. Because high performance learning causes teachers to raise their expectations of children with special educational needs and also provides them with a mechanism to assist those students in their learning. And seeing those students, you know, be confident and proud about their capabilities is a real, real, it's really, really, it's heartwarming. Seeing differences in learning as being something that's really natural rather than a deficiency actually changes everything. That really, we're all of us on continuums. Some of us might be completely dyslexic, some of us are a bit dyslexic, some of us not dyslexic at all. Some of us definitely have ADHD. Some of us struggle to sit still for too long. Some of us are really very good. I would count you in that category. But this focus on removing barriers rather than recognizing the barrier and subsequently lowering the bar has made a significant change, and it makes classrooms truly inclusive. It's about recognizing that people with different strengths come into our classrooms and they are all equally capable. It just takes different ways of working for that to happen. So the Everyone Can agenda creates a positive and optimistic school culture, and that in its turn has an impact on student well-being. So in the latest HPL impact data survey, 91% of students in HPL schools enjoyed attending school. 98% were engaged and confident in their learning, and 79% have few worries about their academic performance. And this includes those from disadvantaged backgrounds and those with special educational needs and disabilities. And you would have to say that these schools are bucking the national and international trends. They really, really are. You are. For teachers accustomed to working within a deficit model, HPL has provided a pedagogy of possibility. And this has proven professionally really rewarding. With the freedom to innovate within a coherent framework, focused on a clear goal that resonates with just about everyone, teachers are just free to develop their professionalism to ever greater levels. That is the reason that the impact data shows that 86% of staff in HPL schools think their career in education is fulfilling and they like going to work. Again, this is against a national and international backdrop of teacher dissatisfaction. So in England, only 59% of teachers are still in the profession after 10 years. So something is clearly working when HPL is the educational methodology within the school. Also mentioned are the breaking down of barriers between pastoral and academic domains. So the VAAs have been seen sometimes as part of a kind of pastoral domain, soft skills, and the ACPs as the academic ones, but seeing them both as interconnected and crucial to effective learning breaks down that barrier, and the results are impressive. HPL has provided a universal language for teaching and learning in a way that I never anticipated. And it turns out it's really useful in enabling really strong professional dialogue across subjects and age groups. So it's an unexpected outcome. So, where next? Well, in the 2016 edition of the Red Book, I reflected on the then current research into school improvement and school effectiveness. And it was clear at that point that whilst the prevailing school improvement model, which is one that has a template definition of what a good school would look like, and has associated inspection systems to see whether you're meeting that template, has been successful. It's brought consistency and acceptable schooling across the system. But it was already well known, understood, and demonstrated that that approach is not the vehicle for creating excellence. It creates consistency and it creates, frankly, mediocrity. It does not create excellence. It deters excellence. Excellence needs a different approach. It needs a move away from the deficit idea, and so deficit and compliance-based model. And instead a move towards a more trust-based model that assumes that things are broadly going well. And where accountability is at the institutional level, with light touch external validation. So researchers and policymakers in 2016 were in alignment regarding the limitations of the school improvement model. And there were researchers who were advocating possible solutions. If you follow the school improvement, school effectiveness research canon, people like Andy Hargreaves and so on, they were making suggestions. But in the last 10 years, nothing has changed. The same model was maintained and strengthened, and the result has been kind of incremental gains on the standard measures. For example, in England, we've risen up the PISA tables. But if you read the results of our rise up the PISA tables, you'll also see that we do not score well for students at either end of the continuum. So those deemed to be the students with low or high ability do not do any better. They are excluded because this is a system which is based on the majority. School improvement focuses on getting consistency for the majority. It doesn't do well with anything on the extremities. And there are also persistent and systematic issues on the borders of genders of inclusivity, well-being, high attainment for everybody, not just some, and a more rounded education that makes students work ready and life ready. That is a pretty comprehensive list of problems. We should not be proud to have those kinds of problems. So now in 2026, the limitations of the school improvement template model really do outweigh its benefits. In England, we've reached the stage where 90% of schools are deemed to be judged as good or outstanding. And so they could all be said to be school improvement compliant. They've already got there, got the tick in the box. But we are maintaining a system which is focused on getting the other 10% there. And at the same time, it's holding back that 90% from going further. We cannot create world-class schools by judging against a narrow set of objectives. It's inadequate. The system needs to evolve, or we will fail to improve further. So this agenda might seem to you to be totally irrelevant for high-performance learning, but it is not. High-performance learning thrives best in the post-standardized agenda beyond school improvement, where it's high trust, in a high trust model, where accountability for success lies first and foremost with each individual institution holding itself to account, rather than what are Ofsted going to say or what are KHDA going to say. We should know what we're trying to do as a school and hold ourselves accountable to our progress towards our own particular vision. It is possible for schools that are working within the school improvement model to implement HPL, but it's just not ideal. The school improvement model's just a bit too restrictive, and I think that's one of the reasons why the growth of HPL schools has been far more significant in international and independent schools than in UK state schools, because in independent and international schools, for the most part, you have more freedom. HPL schools in the UK state system are few, but they are performing really well. But it's proved really difficult to get more schools to adopt. And this makes me sad because it's the disadvantaged students who stand to benefit the most from an HPL type approach, because they're the most at risk of underperformance. So it really is a conundrum. So, when I set out in 2016 to bring new thinking to the education world based on well-attested research in the learning sciences, I thought that once we had some schools using high-performance learning and exemplifying this approach, it would be possible to leverage those schools to be a model and a resource for the system and the profession. The concept would take off and start to change the education landscape. As usual, I was overly optimistic. We have green shoots, but we're certainly not there yet. And the policy landscape is a key factor in this. So, as HPL moves to its next stage, I believe it will be important to try and influence the policymakers globally and persuade them to loosen the reins. And this is not going to be easy. And we will need to build a community of allies, as well as highlighting the success of HPL and HPL schools. It's important to remember in this context that sometimes in the past, schemes that are focused on school or school improvement have come across as cults or movements with their own evangelists. High performance learning is not one of those. It is not a belief system. You do not have to have faith. It is merely a summation of the research evidence. It is what the research is telling us. You are merely following the evidence. So in summary, the last 10 years have demonstrated comprehensively that the HPL approach, when implemented well, has extremely significant benefits and very few drawbacks. It solves many of the systemic problems that have beset more general education, and have done those problems have done so for the last century. So we have schools, teachers and leaders who understand how to make all this work in schools, and who can anticipate any implementation issues and provide solutions. We have an entire organisation led by Gareth working to support teachers through relevant schemes and support. There's a worldwide community of experts, including yourselves, in how to make HPL the DNA of a school. So the stage is set for the next stage of development. For me, it's immensely rewarding to be drawing closer to the answer of how to help the Rohners of this world become those successful learners. The high-performance learning concept is not static. It'll continue to evolve over time in line with emerging evidence, research evidence. But right now, we know it's already excited the students themselves, their teachers, their parents, and that's reward enough. Its progress to date has been a joy to see and hear. But now I need you, all of you, to pick up the baton and be proactive ambassadors, and don't be shy about it. We need to get many more people to understand. We need to emancipate children from the false narratives of the past that trapped their futures in their previous performance or conditions of their birth. As the world moves apparently into much more turbulent times, we need to equip them to better cope with it. And this includes children who people have believed in the past and still believe are not capable of getting there. You have done that. You know it can be done because you're doing it already. You are already ambassadors. I look forward to seeing you, how you're getting on with that, because this work is truly urgent. Thank you.
I'm not good at maths, I'm just not good at it yet. I remember using the analogy once of the driving test, that some people pass their driving test at the first attempt, some people fail it 17 times, but it doesn't mean that that person is intrinsically incapable of passing it. But the problem with the not yet concept is that we have public exams which are inflexible at the moment. It's no use not yet being able to do your maths if you're in your final term before your GCSE or your A-level in maths. And I just wonder where you see the future of our public exam system needs to go in order to sit more comfortably with that concept that children learn at different rates.
So when it comes to our exams and assessment system, I've had many robust conversations with people like Tim Oates on this matter. And I think, you know, we just have to be realistic about the fact that there is a requirement, a need for external bodies to have some kind of sense of pupil attainment at certain given times. What Tim Oates says is the only two good assessment systems are either pass-fail, you just know whether you did or you didn't, or alternatively on a very long, long continuum, where, like the American SATs, where you get a particular spot grade. But they're very inconvenient for the outside world to kind of deal with, and therefore it's inevitable that we're going to have, like, it's like a horse race where you've got, it's Cheltenham at the moment, isn't it, where you've got fences that you have to kind of get over. Now, what I think is really important for us as teachers is that we do not become assessment led. So we do not just teach to the test. because in a way that's totally counterproductive, because the outcome of teaching to the test is twofold. One is your students won't do as well as if you constructed their learning in the way we talk in HPL. So they will do better as a result of being in an HPL kind of an environment. So teaching to the test is just not particularly, it's reductive, because it means that students don't really understand what they're doing. But what you really do want is a mindset within the student which recognises that not everybody can be successful when we have those kinds of summative assessments. But if they're not successful, they still need to come away from it without having a hugely big dent in their confidence. So they still need to know it's not yet. So if you have students who finish up leaving your school, not getting to go to where they wanted to go to as their post-school destination, you absolutely want them to understand that they could do it later, that it's still not yet. And things like the Open University are an absolute testament to the fact that people go back and completely reconfigure themselves. Last year at our HPL conference, I found myself in the bar, as one does, and I was sitting next to somebody. I asked if they were at the same conference, and she said no, she was at a conference for judges. And I said, oh, that's very interesting. And in my mind I'd got this vision of her whole schooling and career trajectory to become a judge. And then she sat and she asked me a bit about what we did, and I sort of briefly said, and she said, I'm really interested in that. She said, because I had lots of problems at school, and I dropped out without any conventional exams at all. And then I went into the workplace, and my employer over time suggested that I might gain some qualifications in finance and accountancy. And she said, and then ultimately one thing led to another, and then, you know, I thought that it was suggested to me I might become a judge. And she said, so I'm a judge in the district. And I'm thinking, you know, that is such a, those stories exist everywhere, but they only exist if we have done the very best we can possibly do for the students while they're in our care, for each and every one of them, but also help them to understand that what comes next is also within their own hands. It's not like, you know, you failed miserably and therefore there's no way back. We had a school that we worked with, do you remember, Melanie, in Kent, which is a selective, Kent has the 11 plus, and this school was not a grammar school. It took students that were had not passed their 11 plus. And the head said, the reason I want to do this is because I am faced every year with a set of year sevens who think they're no good. And I want to recalibrate that to say, you did not pass that test at that time on that day. That does not mean that you are no good and have no future. It's just we need to work longer, try harder. So, you know, I know there's a lot of debate about exam systems and assessment, and, you know, I leave it to others to have that debate, because I feel like the whole of my career, which is very long, we've just been talking about it. We've made, you know, minor adjustments and changes, but we're not going to sweep away exams. Let's just be clear. It's just never going to happen. Nobody's going to be brave enough. So we can advocate and try and change that kind of world, but we have to live within the one we've got, and we want to do the best while by our students while we've got them, and leave and have them leave us thinking they could do more.